Damaso Rivera Fonseca, case number 16-15521. Mr. Katsif.
Yes, may it please the court, Mark Katsif representing Damaso Fonseca. In this case, the district court erred in denying the defendant's motion to suppress the testimonial evidence and also his motion for new trial on the same grounds. The police in this case violated the defendant's invocation of his right to remain silent under the Fifth Amendment in several instances and also as a totality of the circumstances.
Can I ask you one question, Mr. Katsif, before you get into the substance of your argument? Did his girlfriend testify at either the suppression hearing or the trial?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't think she did, but I will have to check that.
Okay, and no problem. Back to the Go right ahead.
But in the first instance, when the defendant was in his holding cell with Agent Brady, and Agent Brady asked him whether he wished to speak and whether he wished to have an attorney present, he said, "Stop right there." At that point, instead of stopping right there, Agent Brady continued to speak with the defendant and ask him questions. That was clearly a violation of his right of invocation to remain silent.
Well, two things. Did at that point, had she finished reading him his rights, or was she in the middle of
I believe she had. But what's interesting about this case is that the way that the series of events unfolded as a factual matter clearly show the egregious behavior of the police. When the defendant was then next taken from his holding cell to the Sallyport to be transported to the jail, he was confronted with the sight of Brigitte Newman, whom you just mentioned, who was sitting in a police car at that precise moment in time in near vicinity of where he was being placed in the police car. The appellant contends that this situation, which the police structured, was designed to elicit statements made by the defendant. And in fact,
didn't the court find that that was not the case, that there's nothing improper with the manner in which the police conducted themselves?
That's correct. But
if that's correct, then isn't the standard of review much higher?
It is much higher, Your Honor, yes. But our contention is that that burden is met in this case.
Is there any evidence that the police had structured the situation in such a way to have the girlfriend present there?
No, but even if they had not structured it, it did place the defendant in a highly vulnerable position, and he did make a statement at that point after he had stated to Agent Brady in the holding cell, "Stop right there." He made a statement. He said, "It's all mine. Let her go."
How much time elapsed between the agent's statements about the process and when he made the statement that you're referring to?
It's my understanding that he explained the process to the defendant in the holding cell. And then this situation where he saw his girlfriend occurred downstairs. But to go back to your point, the second instance, which I didn't mention, in which his right to remain silent was violated, was when, after he had stated, "Stop right there," Agent Brady then proceeded to explain the booking process to him and explain about going to jail. And this was another situation which clearly was designed, it's our contention, of course, it was designed to elicit statements made by the defendant.
Well, let's assume that the agent went beyond the pale in continuing to talk to him after he said, "Stop right there." To try to segment this into portions, at that moment in time, there were no statements, right?
Correct.
Okay, so the first statement is when he sees his girlfriend when he goes downstairs and sees her in another car.
Then the first inculpatory statement.
And then there's the one that follows after that. You want to talk about the second one?
Absolutely. So when he was placed in the vehicle to be taken to the jail, he was with Agent Brady and Officer Littlefield, I believe, at that point. And they continued to at least speak in some fashion to him. And it's during that ride to the jail that he says, I'd rather have, it's better to have a gun than to be, than not to have a gun and be dead. So each of these situations, the appellant would contend, was a violation of his right to remain silent. And it's the conduct of the police, and we can look at the totality of the circumstances. From the holding cell, when he said, stop right there, when Agent Brady said to him, would you like counsel? And then Agent Brady continued to speak with him. And then Agent Brady continued to speak about the booking process and the jail. And this issue is dealt with the case of Johnson, which is in my brief. And then he was taken down to the Sallyport where he was confronted with the side of his girlfriend exactly at that same moment in time in the near vicinity of where he was. And he made his first inculpatory statement. And then he was then taken to the jail and engaged in further conversation by the police officers. The one police officer does say in his testimony that it was a stream of consciousness, but I'm not sure that that's the case when you read the testimony. It clearly wasn't a stream of consciousness. There were statements made by the police in the police car.
Mr. Katz, if in Johnson, wasn't the statement by the officer intended to elicit a response? Isn't that the distinction here? I haven't seen any indication that those initial statements by the officers were intended to elicit responses, explaining what the booking process is or that he's going to jail.
It's our contention that that explanation by the police officer about the booking process and about going to jail is designed to elicit a response. The police officer doesn't have to explain that to him.
What if he asked the question, where are we going? I mean, he's been arrested. What if he asked the question, where are we going, and the officer?
I think the answer is very clear. There should be no answer. If the defendant has invoked his right to silence, there should be no statement made by the police whatsoever. There should be no statement made by the police whatsoever. And we would contend that when you look at the totality of the circumstances, from the holding cell all the way to the right of the jail, the entire time the police were present with the defendant was designed on each occasion to elicit statements, which unfortunately the defendant made.
On with regard to the second statement, Mr. Katzeff, what do you think was the most egregious statement, question, comment made by either of the agents or officers that precipitated the statement?
I think, Your Honor, you have to look, and I hate not to answer your question to give you the answer that you're maybe looking for, but you have to look at the totality of everything together. Because when you keep probing, at some point, a person is going to say something, or they may say something.
Right. I don't disagree with you. I think you have to look at the entire landscape, and you can't isolate one thing from another. But if they had remained silent in the car and said nothing to him on the way to or at the federal detention center, you'd be in a different position.
Very different position.
Right. So what was it that they said as part of the totality of the circumstances between the first statement and the second statement? Do you remember what the record shows, what the officers mentioned or said or discussed?
I'm trying to remember. So in other words, between the holding port and the drive to the jail.
Right, at the Sallyport, that's when he says, it's mine, let her go, or something like that, to that effect, right? And then there's a second statement, and my question is, do you recall?
Yes, I think the most egregious statement was by Agent Brady or Officer Littlefield, I don't recall, but they did say to him at that point, they told him details about the investigation. They mentioned to him, they told him about what Brigitte Newman had said in the Walgreens to the store manager. And that's a very, very clear violation of his right to remain silent when, you know, after a defendant has stated that, stop right there, agents begin discussing the details of the investigation with him. And I also think that this case is not subject to a successful harmless error analysis, because if you take away those two statements, you have a very different case. You have a case that is based upon what one could argue is circumstantial evidence. And I think the only remedy in this case is to reverse the judgment and sentence and remand it for a new trial so that we can proceed with a trial based upon evidence that is or should be admissible under our laws.
All right, Mr. Katzeff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've reserved your full time for rebuttal. Mr. Shadley.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Fritz Shadley on behalf of the United States. Before getting into any argument, I'd like to clarify a few facts based on the discussion that just occurred. And to start that off, I'd like to point to one exhibit that's particularly clarifying regarding the interrogation, well, not interrogation, the conversation, rather, that was had in the interview room at the police department. About a week or a week and a half ago, there was a request from the clerk that the government submit the exhibits from the motion to suppress hearing. Those included several videos and audio files. The government submitted those exhibits about a week and a half ago, and included in that is a video of the interrogation that occurred at the police station. That's exhibit 4 to the motion to suppress hearing.
This is the interrogation after the spontaneous statements?
No, this is the conversation in the interview room where they come in, they give him the Miranda warnings midway through, and this is another clarification. Midway through the Miranda warnings, the defendant makes a statement that he'd like to stop. There's some clarifying questions by the officer. He then says, yeah, I'd like a lawyer. So then she stops with the Miranda right there. She had been mid-flow of the Miranda, and you could see that in the video, and then provides him a brief description of what would happen next, essentially. And she explained in her testimony at the motion to suppress hearing that that was just to be respectful and fair to the defendant. In other words, not take him somewhere without telling them where they were going next. So that, before deciding, I would urge the court to view that video, because it is, I think, everything we would want out of law enforcement in that circumstance. It was cordial, but not overly so. They weren't acting in a way, as the concern articulated in Johnson, that they may be trying to play the good guy. She did the interview. She did it respectfully. He invoked. She gave a brief summation. Of what would happen next. And then after that, the defendant and the officers go to leave the interview room and go to the holding cell. And as they're walking out, the defendant begins to joke with the interviewer, with Officer Agent Brady. And the defendant says, hey, was that, the camera's looking through a one-way mirror. And the defendant says, was that you guys out there videotaping me before? And they're like, oh no, that wasn't us. He says, oh, I was just joking around with you, and does a little shimmy like he had been messing with the people in the camera. So it was a lighthearted, joking exchange at that point. Then the officers and the agents take the defendant to the holding cell, and then he's taken later to the Sally Port and then to the car to be transported to FDC, at which time he sees his girlfriend, Bridget Newman. Now, at the suppression hearing in their argument, defense counsel said that that time period was not more than an hour between the time when there was the invocation, the explanation of the criminal process that would follow, and then the transportation to the interview, to the holding room, and then the transportation to the Sally Port, and then the transportation down to the area where Bridget Newman was seen. As Your Honors mentioned, the district court found that that encounter was in no way arranged. The district court made a finding that there was no evidence or no testimony showing that that was arranged. So that was not an effort at all by the agents or law enforcement officers to bring Bridget Newman there in order to coerce a confession or a statement on behalf of the defendant. So our contention with regard to that exchange there, then, is the government can succeed in one of two ways.
Let me interrupt you for a second. You said the defense argued at the suppression hearing that the time span was no more than an hour?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you think that estimate was correct?
So the record is not entirely clear, Your Honor.
Are there time stamps on any of the video or anything like that?
So
or did any of the officers testify about the length of time?
Correct. So there was an exhibit that would have showed it. That was not the exhibit. That was the exhibit that was not admitted to the motion to suppress hearing. So that was not admitted before the court. That would show the time period in between the end of the invocation and the time at which the defendant was taken to the Sallyport. Apart from that, which is not included in the record, there's a few different aspects that show. There's a comment at one point that it was a short time or a brief period of time. There's a comment where someone says it was a few minutes. And then in its brief at the motion to suppress level, the government stated two things. They said it was at least 20 minutes. And the government then also says that we know that the interview with the defendant where he invoked ended around 10:32. That's what the government represented in its brief at the district court level. They say we know that the defendant was then taken out of the holding cell to the Sallyport later than 10:59. And so that's what the government's representation was at the district court level. And to the extent I can reference the exhibit that was not put into evidence at the district court level, those specific times, the 10:32 and the 10:59, had, in my opinion, had to have been taken from that video, that while it was not attached to the filing and was not admitted at the motion to suppress, it was an explicit reference to times that are drawn from that exhibit. And so the two ways, I believe, regarding the statement, I'll call it the girlfriend statement, the two ways the government can prevail there is, first of all, this wasn't an interrogation. In order for Miranda to apply, there has to be custody plus interrogation. Interrogation is defined in Innis as a statement or action by law enforcement that they should know was reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. And applying that definition to what occurred here, especially after viewing the video, I don't think you could find that it was reasonably likely to lead to or solicit an incriminating response.
That was also true in Johnson, wasn't it?
So Johnson, I would say, is distinguishable than here. Johnson, from my reading, what the court did was they said, here's the course of statements that happened. First, law enforcement started. They said, do you want to know what will happen next? Then law enforcement gave a brief explanation of the criminal justice process that would follow, which is somewhat similar to what occurred here. And then they said, the reason the FBI is interested is because these are checks from a federally insured bank. And immediately after that, the response of the defendant responding to why the FBI is involved is all this trouble for just trying to get a little money. And that was the incriminating statement that was admitted. So the opinion goes on. I mean, first of all, to clarify, we don't have that direct connection that was present in Johnson between the statement by law enforcement that was there reasonably likely to solicit a incriminating response and did directly thereafter about the FBI and the check. We don't have that in our case. After that, another difference is that in Johnson, the court didn't really reason through the interrogation analysis under Innis. What the court did was they, as I mentioned, set out this is the conversation that occurred. And then they said often explanations of criminal rights like this may be a ploy by the government to be the good guy. They said often, and they said it may be a ploy by the government to be a good guy. They didn't rule on a per se basis that this type of discussion between law enforcement and the defendant is inherently or is per se an interrogation. And they didn't really give any further explanation as to their finding, apart from saying that this was inappropriate under Miranda. So you draw the conclusion that they must have found at some point that it was interrogation. A few things we have here that they don't have, though. We have the video. So we have a broader understanding of the interaction that occurred than the mere probably four or five lines in Johnson where they describe the conversation. What we also have is in Innis, when they talk about interrogation, and a couple footnotes, I think 6 and 7, they explain that in evaluating interrogation, it is not irrelevant the officer's intent in asking the question. While it is an objective test, they said it's not irrelevant the officer's intent, and they said it is not irrelevant the officer's knowledge of the susceptibility of the defendant to questioning. Here we know both of those two factors, and they weigh in favor of the government. We know from Agent Brady's testimony that it was not her intent to solicit an incriminating response. It was her intent to be fair and to be respectful to the defendant. She testified that this is what I do with every defendant that I'm going to take into custody. I explain I'm taking them into custody. She did it to be respectful, not to be fair, and in no way did she intend to solicit incriminating statements. And that's clear from the record at the motion to suppress hearing, which is docket entry 97.
Can I switch you over to the second statement for a minute?
Certainly.
What did the officers or agents testify they said, if anything, to Mr. Fonseca between the time they left the Sallyport and the time he made the second set of statements about having a gun?
Right. So the testimony that they gave is that during that drive, Agent Brady's up front, Agent Littlefield's in the back filling out the booking paperwork. They're listening to music. There's no conversation because he's writing in the back. They get on the highway from the Evanshire Police Department. They get in the express lane. There's still no conversation. As they get to be a few minutes away from the FDC here downtown, the defendant initiates the conversation. And this is clear from the motion to suppress hearing and from the testimony at the trial as well. On the motion to suppress hearing, docket entry 97, page 91, government asked, who was the first person to make a statement about the investigation, the defendant or law enforcement? They answered, the defendant. And this was in reference to the car conversation, not to the Sallyport conversation. Who was the first person to speak in that conversation, the defendant or law enforcement? The defendant.
What did he say? He didn't, as I remember the transcript, his first statement was not the statement about the gun, right?
So there are inconsistencies there. And if you look at the cross-examination by defense at the motion to suppress hearing, they say, then while he is driving, or you are driving, this is questioning Agent Brady, when you are driving is when he makes those statements about he knows he's a felon in possession and he carries a gun for protection in those statements, yes. That's when, is it you or Officer Littlefield advise him about Bridget Newman said to him and said about him in the Walgreens? I don't recall who responded back immediately. So saying that he made these statements about the gun and then someone responded back and then they had a conversation about Bridget Newman. So I think—
Did they prepare reports?
I believe there were reports prepared about the conversation that was had.
Were they introduced at the suppression hearing or not?
I don't believe so. So,
what did the officers, what's the clearest version of events about who said what when?
So the clearest version of events is, I believe, the first one I just said, where the officer was asked who was the first person to make a statement about the investigation, the defendant or law enforcement, the defendant, who was the first person to speak in conversation, the defendant or law enforcement, the defendant. So I think it's clear that the defendant...
Well, I know, but that doesn't answer everything. It answers part of it. But if he had said, for example, you know, when did you guys start this investigation of me?
Right.
And stop there. And they said, we started it, you know, at whatever time last night. He hadn't asked anything else. They can't question him then and ask him, why'd you have a gun? Right?
So... I think, to be clear, first of all, I don't think the facts come out that way.
No, I know I know they don't.
Taking that as given, I think there's case law that would say that some sort of conversation bordering on questioning could occur during that time period because he reinitiated. Now, it couldn't be outright interrogation, but if you look at a case like, I believe it was Valdez, where the defendant was in the car, he was on the way to the MCC, and he says, what's going to happen to me now, or where are we going, something along those lines. And then the officer comes back to him and says, we're going to the MCC. He explains that. The defendant says, oh, that's great. That's good. That's better in state. And then he explains to him, the officer goes into it and he says, hey, man, it was a drug case. He says, hey, man, we know you're just doing this because you need the money. You know, we know that you're just doing this because you got to pay for your family. And we're after the bigger guys. So if you talk to your lawyer and you want to come cooperate, then I think that makes sense for you to do something along those lines. And then he immediately thereafter says, yeah, I was only doing it for the money. I got a mortgage, I got a wife, I got a kid. And that statement was held to be admissible. So some sort of interaction, as long as the defendant reinitiates it, there is some sort of interaction that's allowed therein. Here, I don't think we have to go that far because I think the defendant initiated with the statement that's at issue. But if the court were to find...
You think he made that statement first? That was the first thing he said in the car without any prompting as opposed to... a precursor statement and then led to the admission?
So it may not have just been that. There could have been some sort of conversation that or him saying some sort of lead-in statement, and then that without the government giving any sort of question or coercive statement. But what I do think is that the district court level, they found that it was a spontaneous statement. So that says to me that this wasn't something that was in response to law enforcement interaction or law enforcement questioning, but that this was spontaneous. And I think the spontaneity is a factual finding by the district court that is entitled to clear a deference here. So I guess to recap, I think that statement came first, the statement by defendant. I think the district court said that. And even if there was some sort of law enforcement interaction pursuant or following that conversation, I don't think that that was sufficient to require or to be a Miranda violation. And just to clarify, I think these statements should be analyzed, at least the first one should be analyzed independent because it occurred prior to the second one before any of those factors happened. So I think we first have to analyze the girlfriend or the Sallyport statement and then analyze the second statement, which occurred, I believe, without any prior violation of Miranda occurring. Finally, I'll say I think any error in allowing these statements and denying the motion to suppress was harmless based on the evidence that's been put forth in our brief and in the record before the court. And if there are no further questions, I'll rest on
the brief. You have one quick question for you.
Certainly.
The statement in Valdez was made to Agent Brady. Is it the same Agent Brady?
I do not believe it was the same Agent Brady.
Just a coincidence?
I think so, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Shaler, thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Katzeff.
May it please the court. I think it's important to look at these incidents that occurred individually because we're attorneys and judges and that's what we do and we think about analyzing cases in every which way possible. But what's most important, I would suggest, is that you have to look at what happened in this case. You have to look at the fact that at the police conduct beginning in the holding cell and continuing through the series of events, because I don't think that it's certainly possible that the defendant would not have made those statements had the police not spoken to him after he said, stop right there. And with that, the appellant will respectfully rest upon his brief unless the bench has any questions.
Okay, Mr. Castro, thank you very much. And before you head out, Mr. Katzeff, I know that you were court appointed, and we certainly do appreciate the work you've done, not only for your client, but on behalf of the court. It's a public service, and we certainly do appreciate it. Thank you very much.